produce the consequences we expect and desire. The absence of specific depiction, appropriate to inexplicable circumstance, does not alleviate the necessity of appropriate action, even though the nature of that action cannot yet be specified. This means that the nature of the unknown as such must become represented in order to design action patterns which are broadly suited for response to what cannot yet and cannot eternally be predicted or controlled. We are, in fact, capable of a set of paradoxical abilities. We know what to do when we do not know what to do. We know how to represent what to do when we do not know what to do. Finally, we know how to represent what we have not yet encountered. These adaptive capacities, impossible at first glance, immensely further our capacity to behave successfully in the face of our mysterious experience and to communicate and broaden that capacity. If an error in judgment, interpretation, or behavior occurs, and something unexpected appears, that unexpected thing has identifiable properties. It is dangerous and promising. The danger is potential for punishment, frustration, disappointment, social isolation, physical damage, even death. Every moment of threat, however, is simultaneously a moment of opportunity. The change that upsets the presently predictable and orderly also means potential for advancement into a more promising future. The unexpected is information itself, information necessary for the constant expansion of adaptive competence. Such information comes packaged in danger and promise. To gain the information promised, the danger must be overcome. This process of necessary eternal overcoming constantly constructs and transforms our behavioral repertoires and representational schemas. Everything presently known about the subject and objects of human experience was at one time merely the undifferentiated unknown, which was far more than what yet remained to be discovered about the collectively apprehensible sensory qualities of the world. The unknown may manifest itself in the consensually validatable empirical realm as an aspect of the material world. Likewise, it may appear as new significance where none was evident before. What is known and familiar poses no threat, but offers no possibility beyond that which has been previously determined. The explored thing or situation has been associated with behaviors that render it beneficial in the ideal, or at least irrelevant. The omnipresent unknown, by contrast, presents threat and promise infinite in scope, impossible to encapsulate, equally impossible to ignore. The unknown, unexpected, or unpredictable is the source of all conditional knowledge and the place that such knowledge returns to, so to speak, when it is no longer useful. Everything we know because someone explored something they did not understand, explored something they were afraid of, in awe of. Everything we know because someone generated something valuable in the course of an encounter with the unexpected. As the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead has it, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. All things that we know no longer demand our attention. To know something is to do it automatically, without thinking, to categorize it at a glance or less than a glance, or to ignore it entirely. The nervous system is designed to eliminate predictability from consideration and to focus limited analytical resources where focus would produce useful results. We attend to the places where change is occurring, where something is happening that has not yet been modeled, where something is happening that has not yet had behaviors erected around it, where something is happening that is not yet understood. Consciousness itself might be considered as that organ which specializes in the analysis and classification of unpredictable events. Attention and concentration naturally gravitate to those elements in the experiential field that contain the highest concentration of novelty, or that are the least expected, prior to what might normally be considered higher cognitive processing. The nervous system responds to irregular change and eliminates regularity. There is limited information, positive and negative, in the predictable. The novel occurrence, by contrast, might be considered a window into the transcendent space where reward and punishment exist in eternal and unlimited potential. The unknown or unexpected or novel appears when plans go wrong, when behavioral adaptation or interpretive schema fails to produce what is desired or to predict what occurs. The appearance of the unexpected or unpredictable inhibits ongoing goal-directed activity in the absence of conscious volition. Concurrently with this inhibition of activity comes inexorable redirection of attention toward the unexpected event. The unexpected grips behavior and spontaneously generates antithetical affects, varying in intensity with the improbability of the occurrence, creating heightened interest, fear, intense curiosity, or outright terror. This motivational significance appears to have been experienced as an intrinsic feature of the unknown, prior to the strict formal modern division of experiential world into empirical object and subjective observer, and is still fundamentally experienced in that manner today. Rudolf Otto, in his seminal investigation into the nature of religious experience, described such experience as numinous, involuntarily gripping, indicative of significance beyond the normal and average. The numinous experience has two aspects: mysterium tremendum, which is capacity to invoke trembling and fear, and mysterium fascinans, capacity to powerfully attract, fascinate, and compel. This numinous power, divine import, is extreme affective relevance and concomitant direction of behavior by the unknown object. This power is commonly considered by those subject to it as a manifestation of God, personification of the unknown, and ultimate source of all conditional knowledge, as Otto states. The feeling of it may at times come sweeping like a gentle tide, pervading the mind with a tranquil mood of deepest worship. It may pass over into a more set and lasting attitude of the soul, continuing, as it were, thrillingly vibrant and resonant, until at last it dies away and the soul resumes its profane, non-religious mood of everyday experience. It may burst in sudden eruptions up from the depths of the soul, with spasms and convulsions, or lead to the strangest excitements, to intoxicated frenzy, to transport, and to ecstasy. It has its wild and demonic forms, and can sink to an almost grisly horror and shuddering. It has its crude, barbaric antecedents and early manifestations, and again it may be developed into something beautiful and pure and glorious. It may become the hushed, trembling, and speechless humility of the creature in the presence of whom or what? In the presence of that which is a mystery, inexpressible, and above all creatures. Nothing that is not represented can be said to be understood, not as we normally use that term. Nonetheless, understanding of the unknown, which cannot in theory be represented, is vital to continued survival. Desire to represent the unknown, to capture its essence, is in consequence potent enough to drive the construction of culture, the net that constrains the unknowable source of all things. The impetus for representation of the domain of the unexpected arose and arises as a consequence of the intrinsic, biologically determined, affective or emotional significance of the unknown or novel world. Representations of the unknown constitute attempts to elaborate upon its nature, to illuminate its emotional and motivational significance, to illuminate its being from the pre-scientific or mythic perspective. This is categorization of all that has not yet been explored and represented in the service of adaptation to that which has not yet been understood. This is the attempt to formulate a conception of the category of all as of yet uncategorized things, so that a useful stance might be adopted with regard to that category. The novel ceaselessly inspires thought and allows itself to be entangled, yet inevitably transcends all attempts at final classification. The unknown, therefore, provides a constant, powerful source of energy for exploration and the generation of new information. Desire to formulate a representation of that which supersedes final classification and remains eternally motivating might well be understood as a prepotent and irresistible drive. That drive constitutes what might be regarded as the most fundamental religious impulse, constitutes the culturally universal attempt to define and establish a relationship with God, and underlies the establishment of civilized historical order. The product of this drive, the culturally constructed complex extant in fantasy, the symbol, composed of communicable representation of all things constantly threatening and promising to man, affects and structures the experience of each individual, yet remains impersonal, distinct, and separate. As Carl Jung states, the living symbol formulates an essential unconscious factor, and the more widespread this factor is, the more general is the effect of the symbol, for it touches a corresponding chord in every psyche. Since, for a given epoch, it is the best possible expression for what is still unknown, it must be the product of the most complex and differentiated minds of that age. But, in order to have an effect at all, it must embrace what is common to a large group of men. This can never be what is most differentiated, the highest attainable, for only a very few attain to that or understand it. The common factor must be something that is still so primitive that its ubiquity cannot be doubted. Only when the symbol embraces that and expresses it in the highest possible form is it of general efficacy. Herein lies the potency of the living social symbol and its redeeming power. This dynamic representation might form part of the subjective experience of a myriad of people, and therefore have its own biologically grounded, culturally determined existence independent of any given person at any given time, even to follow its own intrinsic rules of development, yet fail to exist objectively as the objective is currently understood. Ritualized, dramatic, or mythic representations of the unknown, the domain that emerges when error is committed, appear to have provided the initial material for the most primordial and fundamental aspects of formalized religions. Appreciation of the nature of the unknown as a category developed as a consequence of observation of our inherent response to what we did not expect, manifested as predictable pattern of affect and behavior. Fear and curiosity, terror and hope, inhibition of ongoing activity and cautious exploration, habituation and generation of novel and situation-specific appropriate behavioral strategies. Two things are the same from the empirical viewpoint if they share collectively apprehended sensory features. Two things are the same from the metaphoric, dramatic, or mythical perspective, from the perspective of the natural category, if they produce the same subjective state of being, affect or motivation, or have the same functional status, which is implication for behavior. Experiences that share affective tone appear categorizable in single complexes, symbolic in nature, from the standpoint of abstract cognition, appear as products of culture which evolved in the social environment characteristic of ancestral Homo sapiens and later disappeared. Such complexes might play a useful role in the promotion of general adaptive behavior in the face of feared and promising objects, in the absence of detailed exploration-generated information regarding the explicit nature of these objects. These representations might be considered the consequence of first-level representation, of imitation, as Piaget pointed out, and then, later, the consequence of more abstracted second-order representation, of symbolic understanding. Understanding can be reached at the most inclusive, yet primary level, through ritual and mimesis, an unknown phenomenon, gripping but incomprehensible, can yet be represented ritually, can be acted out. Secondary representation of this acting out constitutes the initial form of abstract representation. To understand the lion, for example, or the hunted beast, it is first necessary to become the lion or the hunted beast, to mimic physically, and later to represent the mimicry in imagination. It is in this manner that the son imitates the father, whom he will later become. A child's embodiment of the parent means his incorporation of the knowledge of the parent, at least insofar as that knowledge is action. The child acts out his father, without understanding him, and without understanding the reasons for his acting out. It could be said, metaphorically, that the imitating child is possessed by the spirit of the father, as the father was possessed in his own childhood. The spirit of the father may be conceived in this representational schema as an entity independent of the particular father or the particular son, as something that manifests itself in imagination and in possession of behavior generation after generation in more or less constant and traditional form. Similarly, the unknown, which might be considered object and subject simultaneously, which manifests itself in the perceptible world in affect and which grips behavior, might well be regarded as, or manifest itself in imagination as, a transpersonal entity, or as the result of the actions of a transpersonal entity. The ancestral primordial hunter, terrified by something unknown in the bush, portrays his encounter with what frightened him by acting out the unknown demon when he returns to the village. This acting out is simultaneously embodiment and representation. It is basic level hypothesis regarding the nature of the unknown as such. Alternatively, perhaps, he fashions an image, an idol of the thing, and gives concrete form to what until then is merely behavioral compulsion. The unknown first appears symbolically as an independent personality when it cannot be conceived of in any other fashion, and later appears as if it were a personality, in evidently metaphoric guise. Evidence for the adoption of personality by representational or quasi-representational complexes is plentiful. Such complexes may construct themselves over the course of many centuries as a consequence of the exploratory and creative endeavors of many disparate individuals united within the communicative network of culture. It is in this manner, over vast stretches of time, that the transpersonal domain of the imagination becomes populated with spirits. Jung described the space occupied by such spirits as the pleroma, a Gnostic term. The pleroma might be described as the subjective world of experience, in remembrance, the episodic world, perhaps from the perspective of modern memory theory. Although representations apparently collectively apprehensible under certain peculiar circumstances, like those of the Virgin Mary in Yugoslavia prior to the devastating Serbian-Bosnian Muslim War, or those of alien spaceships, UFOs, during the Cold War, also make their home there. The Pleroma is the space in which heaven and hell have their existence, the place where Plato's supra-celestial ideals reside, the ground of dream and fantasy. It appears to have a four-dimensional structure like that of objective space-time and of memory, but is characterized by a tremendous vagueness with regards to category and temporality. The spirits which inhabit the Pleroma in its natural condition are deities. Undifferentiated mixes of subject and object, motivational significance and sensory aspect, elaborated into personified representations by the efforts of many. This is merely to say that a representation is a social construct with historical, even biological, roots, like any idea, and that the spirit who inhabits the imagination is not necessarily a figment created by the person who has that imagination. The devil is not the product of the particular Christian. It is more accurate to note that the figure of the devil, or of Christ for that matter, inhabits the mind of the Christian and of all Christians, and that such habitation occurs as a consequence of transpersonal social and historical processes operating almost completely beyond the realm of individual control. The child, similarly, cannot be said to create the monsters that live in his imagination. They grow there, so to speak, and are then subjectively observed, are fed by casual statements on the part of adults, by action patterns the child observes but cannot explain, by emotions and motivational states that emerge suddenly and unpredictably, by the fantasies in books, on TV, and in the theater. Events or experiences that remain beyond the reach of exploration, assimilation, and accommodation stay firmly entrenched in, or automatically ascribed to, the domain of the unknown, threatening, and promising. The category of all events that cannot yet be categorized can nonetheless be modeled. Through metaphoric application of partially comprehensible yet affect-inducing occurrences whose emotional relevance in some way matches that of the unknown. Each of the specific things that signifies danger, for example, or alternatively the enhancement of life, appears easily associated with every other specific thing characterized by the same property, as well as with novelty itself, which produces fear and hope as part of its subjectively intrinsic nature. These experiences appear interassociated on the basis of the similar affective or behavioral states they inspire, the motivational effects they engender prior to development of habituation in course of exploratory behavior. The archaic limbic system has its own method of classification, so to speak, experienced privately as emotion, or as behavior spontaneously undertaken, manifested outside the realm of conditional, abstract, culturally determined presumption. Everything novel encountered, avoided because of involuntary or willfully manifested fear or ignorance, is potentially or actively linked with all that remains outside of individual competence and or cultural classification. Everything that produces fear may be subjectively considered one aspect of the same subterranean thing. What is that thing? The unknown as such surrounds all things, but exists only in a hypothetical state, and finds representation in symbolic form as the Ouroboros, as we have seen. The disintegration or division of the Ouroboros gives rise to all things, including the disorder or unpredictability that is defined in opposition to what has been explored. This more narrowly defined domain of disorder or unpredictability, which is the unknown as it is actually experienced rather than as a hypothetical entity, tends to be portrayed as something distinctly feminine, as the daughter of the great serpent, as the matrix of all determinate being. It is useful to regard the Great Mother as the primary agent of the serpent of chaos, as the serpent's representative, so to speak, in the profane domain. The serpent of chaos can be seen lurking behind the Great Mother, as we shall see, and she often adopts reptilian, material, or bird-like, spiritual features. This relationship is schematically represented in Figure 32, Novelty, the Great Mother, as daughter of the Ouroboros. In the incarnation depicted, the Great Mother is Venus, goddess of fertility and love. As the Winged Mother, bird and matter, she is spirit and earth at once. The wings might just as easily be replaced by the icon of a snake, which would tie her figure more closely to the earth and to the idea of transformation. The capsule that surrounds her, for example, frequently found enveloping Christ as Son of the Divine Mother, or Mary, the Divine Mother herself, in late medieval and early Renaissance art, is the mandorla, or vesica piscis, the fish's bladder, which appears to have served a sexual symbolic representation of the source of all things since well before written history began. The Ouroboros and the figure of the Great Mother commonly overlap because the chaos comprising the original state is hard to distinguish from the chaos defined in opposition to established order. Two things that have no distinguishable features, as is the case for the two domains of chaos, are difficult to separate from one another. The distinctions between the figures of the Ouroboros and the Great Mother are just as important as their similarities, however. An immense difference obtains between the possibility of something unknown and an actual unknown, the difference between potential and reality. Eliade provides an example of a careful attempt to disentangle the categories drawn from Lao Tzu. In another cosmogonic fragment, the Tao is denominated an undifferentiated and perfect being born before heaven and earth. We can consider it the mother of this world, but I do not know its name. I will call it Tao, and if it must be named, its name will be the immense. The undifferentiated and perfect being is interpreted by a commentator of the 2nd century BC thus. The mysterious unity of heaven and earth chaotically constitutes the condition of the uncarved block. Hence, the Tao is a primordial totality, living and creative, but formless and nameless. That which is nameless is the origin of heaven and earth. That which has a name is the mother of the 10,000 beings. The unknown, as such, is the thing in and of itself. By contrast, the unknown as encountered by a determinate subject in a particular situation is the matrix of all being, the actual source of information that, once explored and categorized, constitutes cosmos or order, and for that matter, exploring agent. Lao Tzu also says, in an attempt to further clarify the situation, the divinity of the valley does not die. It is the obscure female. The gate of the obscure female, that is the origin of heaven and earth. The unknown appears to be generally conceptualized or symbolically represented as female, primarily because the female genitalia, hidden, private, unexplored, productive, serve as gateway or portal to the divine unknown world or source of creation, and therefore easily come to stand for that place. Novelty and femininity share analogical or categorical identity from this perspective. Both constitute a window, so to speak, into the world beyond. Woman, insofar as she is subject to natural demands, is not merely a model for nature. She is divine nature in imagination and actuality. She literally embodies the matrix of biological being and provides, as such, an appropriate figure for the metaphoric modeling of the ground of everything. The female body constitutes the border between normal experience and the totality from which all forms emerge. Infants come from mothers. This hypothesis, based upon direct observation, accounts for the provisional source of particular individuals. The origin, per se, partakes of the same essential ineffable nature, partakes of whatever is characteristic of the experienceable mother, and other identifiable points of origin which cannot be described or comprehended so easily, such as the caves where ores grow and mature, or the ground where crops thrive. The matrix of all things is something feminine, like the mothers of experience. It is something with an endlessly fecund and renewed, maternal and virginal, nature, something that defines fertility and therefore femininity itself. Things come from somewhere. All things have their birthplace. The relationship of man writ large to nature, eternal mother, endlessly mimics that of the particular child to his personal mother. Or, to be more accurate, the child and the mother mimic life and the world. The unknown, as it can be encountered, is female with paradoxical qualities. The great and terrible mother of all things promises endlessly. She also threatens absolutely. The outcome of an encounter with the unknown, which constitutes the necessary precondition for the generation of new information, for generation of the cosmos and of the experiencing subject, cannot be specified beforehand. Something new might benefit or destroy. Femininity shares emotional valence with novelty and threat, furthering the utility of the female as metaphoric grist, because of the union that exists within experience between creation of one thing and destruction and transformation of another. The process of embryogenesis itself requires that blood change form as the fetus thrives on the blood of its mother. The act of birth itself is traumatic, painful, dangerous, and frightening, recapitulating the natural theme of creation, transformation, and destruction. Nourishment is linked integrally with death and terror, even from the beginning, when the metamorphosis of blood into milk transforms the mother into food for the infant. Nature is feminine, in addition, because of the isomorphic relationship that exists between childhood dependency on maternal beneficence and caprice and adult subjugation to biological reality. Human infants are prepared instinctively to establish relationship with the mother and to respond with vitality to manifestation of maternal interest. Every individual's primordial world experience is experience of mother, who is the world itself in initial developmental stages, insofar as the world has any motivational significance whatsoever. Indeed, for individuals who are sufficiently stunted in their psychological development, the world never evolves into anything other beyond mother. Furthermore, the ontogenesis of the individual and the mother-child symbiosis is comparable to the phylogenesis of humanity and the relationship of that humanity with, or its dependence upon, earth and sea. The archetypal infantile situation, which extends back into time prior to the establishment of culture itself, is recapitulated in adulthood with the maternal object of fear and respect, hope, love, and gratitude abstracted into experience itself. The threatening aspects of the Great Mother gather metaphoric representation as chimeras of anxiety-producing places, animals, gestures, expressions, and things. These elements, diverse from the objective perspective, from the standpoint of the proper set, nonetheless unite to produce an image of the ever-present potential danger inherent in anything unpredictable. The Great Mother, unexplored territory, is the dark, the chaos of the night, the insect, ophidian, and reptilian worlds, the damaged body, the mask of anger or terror, the entire panoply of fear-inducing experiences commonly encountered and imagined by Homo sapiens. A dynamic complex of such objects appears as the most subtle and exact representation of the unknown imaginable, something capable simultaneously of characterizing the active bite of the snake, the life of fire, the sting of the scorpion, the trap of the spider. The most suitable embodiment of the manifest desire of nature's vital transformative forces, generative of death, dissolution, destruction, and endless creation. Feared experiences, grounded in the inexplicable, acquire representation in fantasy as fear-producing spirits. These spirits, clothed in particular anxiety-provoking occurrences, give form to aspects of experience that otherwise remain inexplicable. Beyond understanding from the perspective of conditional adaptation, action, and abstract thought, but impossible to ignore from the standpoint of affect. The personality of such beings constitutes the embodiment of incomprehensible and often intolerable motivational significance, comprises representation of the ground of violent emotional experience, capable of inducing cognitive and behavioral possession, impossible to incorporate into the domain of normal, culturally established being. Figure 33, the spontaneous personification of unexplored territory, presents one such figure and its process of development in comical form. Equivalent but more serious dynamic representations of this type are deities, gods born of human experience, possessed of quasi-objective transpersonal status, like the Word, manifestations of the unfamiliar, the other, the unknown, and the unpredictable. What can now be calmly described as an archaic symbol or god from the past may also reasonably be considered as the manifestation of a primeval, independent personality, the unified embodiment in ritual or imagination of some set of phenomena united by their affective or functional equivalents. These personalities, deities, have with time lost affective and conceptual relevance as a consequence of the constant expansion of human adaptive capacity and have become broken down into less complex, more determinate aspects of experience. In their original form, however, these representational personalities revealed themselves within the creative compensatory experience of exceptional individuals beset by their own incomprehensible, although not purely idiosyncratic, personal tragedy. Concrete realization of such manifestation, transformation into an artistic production or potent story, for example, involuntarily seized the attention of peers and inspired a sense of fascination and awe. Centuries-long cultural elaboration of such production gave rise to the elaborated existence of transpersonal beings of transcendent power who inhabited the space defined by the collective imagination of mankind and who behaved in accordance with the dictates of their own irrational, myth-predicated souls. These representations served as active images, detailing to everyone what was as of yet explicitly unknown, only partially known. They pointed the way toward aspects of experience beyond the grasp of conscious abstract apprehension, but dangerous to ignore. It is no simple manner for the limited subject to formulate an accurate representation of the unlimited unknown, of nature, the ground of existence. The unknown is the matrix of everything, the source of all birth and the final place of rest. It hides behind our personal identity and our culture. It constantly threatens and engenders all that we do, all that we understand, and all that we are. It can never be eliminated permanently from consideration, since every solution merely provides the breeding place for a host of new problems. The unknown is Homo sapiens' everlasting enemy and greatest friend, constantly challenging individual facility for adaptation and representation, constantly pushing men and women to greater depths and more profound heights. The unknown as nature appears as paradoxical, formidable, overwhelming power applied simultaneously in one direction and its opposite. Hunger, the will to self-preservation, drives living creatures to devour each other rapaciously, and the hunters have no mercy for the hunted. Sexuality bends the individual will inexorably and often tragically to the demand of the species, and existence maintains itself in endless suffering, transformation, and death. Life generates and destroys itself in a pitiless cycle, and the individual remains constantly subject to forces beyond understanding or control. The desire to exist permeates all that lives and expresses itself in terrible fashion, in uncontrollable impulse, in an endless counterpoint of fecundity and decay. The most basic, fundamental, and necessary aspects of experience are, at the same time, most dangerous and unacceptable. Empirical, classical objects are either one thing or another. Nature, by contrast, the great unknown, is one thing and its affective opposite at the same time and in the same place. The novel, primeval experience was and remains much too complex to be gripped initially by rational understanding as understood in the present day. Mythic imagination, willing to sacrifice discriminatory clarity for inclusive phenomenological accuracy, provided the necessary developmental bridge. The earliest embodiments of nature are therefore symbolic combinations of rationally irreconcilable attributes, monsters, essentially feminine, who represent animal and human, creation and destruction, birth and cessation of experience. The analytical psychologist Eric Neumann, who wrote a definitive, comprehensive, and useful book on the symbolism of the feminine, the Great Mother, states, "In the early phases of consciousness, the numinosity, that is, the emotional valence, of the archetype exceeds man's power of representation, so much so that at first no form can be given to it. And when later the primordial archetype takes form in the imagination of man, its representations are often monstrous and inhuman. This is the phase of the chimerical creatures composed of different animals or of animal and man, the griffins, sphinxes, harpies, for example, and also of such monstrosities as phallic and bearded mothers. It is only when consciousness learns to look at phenomena from a certain distance, to react more subtly, to differentiate and distinguish, this is a function of exploration and its related abstract processes, that the mixture of symbols prevailing in the primordial archetype separates into the groups of symbols characteristic of a single archetype or of a group of related archetypes. In short, that they become recognizable. The terrible aspects of the primordial Great Mother have been represented, symbolized, in a variety of manners, but her underlying reality and essential ideation remain immediately recognizable. Neumann states, "These figures are gruesomely alike. Their sheer frightfulness makes us hesitate, whether they represent a skull, the head of a snake or hippopotamus, a face showing human likeness, or a head consisting of two stone knives borne by a body pieced together from parts of snakes, panthers, lions, crocodiles, and human beings. So great is the inhuman, extrahuman, and superhuman quality in this experience of dread that man can visualize it only through phantoms. But all this, and it should not be forgotten, is an image not only of the feminine, but particularly and specifically of the maternal. For in a profound way, life and birth are always bound up with death and destruction. That is why this terrible mother is great, and this name is also given to the Egyptian Ta-Urt, the gravid monster, which is hippopotamus and crocodile, lioness and woman in one. She, too, is deadly and protective. There is a frightening likeness to Hathor, the good cow goddess, who in the form of a hippopotamus is the goddess of the underworld. She has a positive aspect, and at the same time, she is the goddess of war and death. In the course of the later development of patriarchal values, i.e., of the male deities of the sun and light, the negative aspect of the feminine was submerged. Today, it is discernible only as a content of the primordial age or of the unconscious. Thus, the terrible Ta'urt, as well as the terrible Hathor, Isis, Nith, and others, can be reconstituted from their pictures that have been painted over but cannot be viewed directly. Only the monster Amit or Ammon, which devours the souls condemned at the judgment of the dead, points by its parallelism to the terrible aspect of Ta'urt. Amit was described as follows. Her forepart is that of crocodiles, her hinder part is that of hippopotamus, and her middle is that of a lion. The feminine animal mother character of this many-breasted creature is evident, as is that of the monster wielding the terrible knife which guards one of the underworld gates through which the souls of the departed must pass. Amit devours the souls that have not withstood the midnight judgment of the dead in the underworld, but her role has become subordinate, for the religion of Osiris and Horus, with its mysteries, has now promised rebirth and resurrection to all human souls, and not only, as originally, to the soul of Pharaoh. The certainty of magical success in following the path of the sun, which is communicated to each man after death by the priests, has overlaid the primordial fear represented by Amit. But originally, she was the terrible ancestral spirit of the matriarchal culture, in which the feminine takes back what has been born of it, just as among the primitive inhabitants of the Melanesian island of Melicula or in the high culture of Mexico. The terrible mother challenges and threatens the individual, absolutely. She is goddess of anxiety, depression, and psychological chaos, goddess of the possibility of pain and death. She is horror, insofar as horror can be imagined, and is the ground of that horror beyond. She exposes and turns to her advantage constant mortal vulnerability. She barters, paradoxically, offering continuance of life for sacrificial death. She demands reconciliation without offering the certainty of survival. She embodies the potential for salvation and the central problem of life, impels the individual involuntarily toward further expansion of consciousness, or induces involuntary contraction leading to death. The Great Mother impels, pushes with certainty of mortality, and pulls with possibility of redemption, development of consciousness and of self-consciousness. The identity of death with the unknown has permanently and incurably destroyed any possibility of final habituation to, adaptation to, more accurately, the world of experience. Man, as Eric Neumann points out, is in consequence the incurably anxious animal. Thus, the womb of the earth becomes the deadly devouring maw of the underworld, and beside the fecundated womb and the protective cave of earth and mountain gapes the abyss of hell, the dark hole of the depths, the devouring womb of the grave and death, and darkness without light of nothingness. For this woman who generates life and all living things on earth is the same who takes them back into herself, who pursues her victims and captures them with snare and net. Disease, hunger, hardship, war above all are her helpers, and among all peoples, the goddesses of war and the hunt express man's experience of life as a female exacting blood. This terrible mother is the hungry earth, which devours its own children and fattens on their corpses. It is the tiger and the vulture and the coffin, the flesh-eating sarcophagus voraciously licking up the blood seed of men and beasts, and once fecundated and sated, casting it out again in new birth, hurling it to death, and over again to death. The terrible feminine has been represented by figures such as the Chimera, the Sphinx, the Griffin, and the Gorgon, which combined and unified the most disparate yet related aspects of nature, those aspects which, individually, intrinsically, inspire terror and deference. Gorgon-like figures and their sisters appear commonly throughout the world. As the Aztec Coatlicue, whose gruesome headdress was composed of skulls, the terrible mother was goddess of death and dismemberment, object of sacrificial homage. As goddess of the snake, she was sacred in ancient Crete and worshipped by the Romans. Her modern equivalents remain extant in Bali and India. Kali, Hindu goddess, portrayed in figure 34, unexplored territory as destructive mother, is eight-armed like a spider and sits within a web of fire. Each of her arms bears a tool of creation or weapon of destruction. She wears a tiara of skulls, has pointed phallic breasts and aggressive staring eyes. A snake, symbol of ancient impersonal power, transformation and rebirth, is coiled around her waist. She simultaneously devours and gives birth to a full-grown man. Medusa, Greek monster, with her coif of snakes, manifests a visage so terrible that a single exposure turns strong men to stone, paralyzes them permanently with fear. This Gorgon is a late vestigial remnant, so to speak, of an early goddess who simultaneously embodied nature's incredible productive fecundity and callous disregard for life. A neuropsychological description of the brain's response to the unexpected, such as we encountered earlier, is one thing. The mythological representation is another. Consideration of the figure of the great and terrible mother is salutary, helps breed understanding of just what it is that our cultures, that is, our ritual identification with the dead, protects us from. We are shielded from the terrors of our imagination and from the things that breed such terror by the overlay of familiarity granted by shared frameworks of action and interpretation. These walls serve their purpose so well that it is easy for us to forget our mortal vulnerability. Indeed, we generated those walls to aid that forgetting. But it is impossible to understand why we are so motivated to maintain our cultures, our beliefs, and associated patterns of action without gazing at and appreciating the horrible figures generated by our ancestors. The Great Mother in her negative guise is the force that induces the child to cry in the absence of her parents. She is the branches that claw at the night traveler in the depths of the forest. She is the terrible force that motivates the commission of atrocity, planned rape and painful slaughter during the waging of war. She is aggression without the inhibition of fear and guilt, sexuality in the absence of responsibility, dominance without compassion, greed without empathy. She is the Freudian id, unconsciousness contaminated with the unknown and mortal terror and the flies in the corpse of a kitten. She is everything that jumps in the night, that scratches and bites, that screeches and howls. She is paralyzing dismay, horror, and the screams that accompany madness. The Great Mother aborts children and is the dead fetus, breeds pestilence and is the plague. She makes of the skull something gruesomely compelling and is all skulls herself. To unveil her is to risk madness, to gaze over the abyss, to lose the way, to remember the repressed trauma. She is the molester of children, the golem, the boogeyman, the monster in the swamp, the rotting, cadaverous zombie who threatens the living. She is progenitor of the devil, the strange son of chaos. She is the serpent and Eve, the temptress. She is the femme fatale, the insect in the ointment, the hidden cancer, the chronic sickness, the plague of locusts, the cause of drought, the poisoned water. She uses erotic pleasure as bait to keep the world alive and breeding. She is a gothic monster who feeds on the blood of the living. She is the water that washes menacingly over the ridge of the crumbling dam, the shark in the depths, the wide-eyed creature of the deep forests, the cry of the unknown animal, the claws of the grizzly, and the smile of the criminally insane. The great and terrible mother stars in every horror movie, every black comedy. She lies in wait for the purposefully ignorant, like a crocodile waits in the bog. She is the mystery of life that can never be mastered. She grows more menacing with every retreat. I dreamed I saw my maternal grandmother sitting by the bank of a swimming pool, which was also a river. In real life, she had been a victim of Alzheimer's disease and had regressed to a semi-conscious state. In the dream as well, she had lost her capacity for self-control. Her genital region was exposed dimly. It had the appearance of a thick mat of hair. She was stroking herself absent-mindedly. She walked over to me, with a handful of pubic hair compacted into something resembling a large artist's paintbrush. She pushed this at my face. I raised my arm several times to deflect her hand. Finally, unwilling to hurt her or interfere with her any further, I let her have her way. She stroked my face with the brush gently and said, like a child, "Isn't it soft?" I looked at her ruined face and said, "Yes, Grandma, it's soft." Out from behind her stepped an old white bear. It stood to her right, to my left. We were all beside the pool. The bear was old, like little dogs get old. It could not see very well, seemed miserable, and behaved unpredictably. It started to growl and wave its head at me, just like little mean dogs growl and look just before they bite you. It grabbed my left hand in its jaws. We both fell into the pool, which was by this time more like a river. I was pushing the bear away with my free hand. I yelled, "Dad, what should I do?" I took an axe and hit the bear behind the head hard a number of times, killing it. It went limp in the water. I tried to lift its body onto the bank. Some people came to help me. I yelled, "I have to do this alone." Finally, I forced it out of the water. I walked away, down the bank. My father joined me and put his arm around my shoulder. I felt exhausted, but satisfied. The unknown never disappears. It is a permanent constituent element of experience. The ability to represent the terrible aspects of the unknown allow us to conceptualize what has not yet been encountered and to practice adopting the proper attitude toward what we do not understand. From the Nag Hammadi Library. For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. The positive aspect of the matrix of all being, the twin sister of Kali, so to speak, stands in marked contrast to the terrible mother. The beneficial unknown is the source of eternal plenitude and comfort. It is positive femininity, metaphorically speaking, that constitutes the ground for hope itself, for the faith and belief in the essential goodness of things necessary to voluntary maintenance of life and culture. The beneficial sister has in consequence acquired breadth and depth of metaphoric mythic representation equivalent to that of the terrible mother. The beneficent aspect of the matrix of all things, the eternally fecund virgin, because eternally renewed, the mother of the Savior, is the embodiment of the helpful source, a constant aid to painful travail, tragic suffering, and existential concern. Redemptive knowledge itself springs from the generative encounter with the unknown, from exploration of aspects of novel things and novel situations, is part of the potential of things, implicit in them, intrinsic to their nature. This redemptive knowledge is wisdom, knowledge of how to act, generated as a consequence of proper relationship established with the positive aspect of the unknown, the source of all things. Wisdom is radiant and unfading, and she is easily discerned by those who love her, and is found by those who seek her. She hastens to make herself known to those who desire her. He who rises early to seek her will have no difficulty, for he will find her sitting at his gates. To fix one's thought on her is perfect understanding.